ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If you've ever been out of work, you know what a grind looking for a job can be. And our current unemployment system leaves a lot to be desired.
I've never once been offered a job. I've never once been offered training whatsoever.
The federal government has announced a major overhaul, moving away from a one-size-fits-all approach. So will it help? That's in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, teenagers are digital natives, right? They're the ones teaching you how to turn off annoying notifications and reminding you that your phone torch is on again. But they're not invincible online. In fact, many of them are missing tech literacy basics. So maybe it's time for you to help them. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, every year, the Queensland government allows up to 190 tonnes of coral to be harvested and sold into the aquarium trade. If that number shocked you, I'll be honest, it shocked me as well. Australia is the second largest exporter of coral in the world. And while industry members say they are well regulated with a lot of oversight from various levels of government, conservation advocates want change. A new campaign by the Australian Marine Conservation Society has called for live coral harvesting to be phased out by December 2028. Do we need to reconsider our position, or is the reef sustainable enough to keep this trade going? You'll hear from one of the campaigners in a tick, along with a biologist who's helping with some creative ways to keep the reef alive for future generations. But first, Lyle Squire Jr. is the CEO of Cairns Marine, which supplies marine life for display in aquaria. He's the third generation of his family in this industry. Lyle, welcome to Life Matters.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
How much coral do you harvest from the reef each year?
This is a golden question. And to be perfectly honest, you said that you were shocked to hear the 190 ton. And I would concede I'd be shocked as well. And so one of the questions I would actually put to Simon is how much Scleractinian hard coral has actually been collected for the last 2 years. So I'm curious to know whether he knows those numbers, whether it's a deliberate act on the part of MCS to provide misinformation to the public in order to drive their campaign.
Without getting too weedy, Lyle, let's talk about that in a sec I introduce the Australian Marine Conservation Society. But for you, for Cairns Marine, can you put a number around what's harvested each year?
I can, but I'm very keen to hear Simon tell us how much has been collected, given that he's going publicly and telling everybody 190 ton.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about your work and the work that you do first? Who is the primary buyer of the corals and the other marine life that you supply to aquaria?
Look, the corals go to a variety of different places. Some corals do go to hobbyists around the world and within Australia. But the industry also supplies researchers around the planet and across, like our company also provides five or six universities within Australia, all doing research on protecting corals. And then also the industry is a fundamental partner with the Australian Institute of Marine Science presently in their efforts for the reef restoration adaptation plan, looking at putting hundreds of thousands of devices out on the reef of heat-tolerant corals. And so we're a very strategic partner in that. And the ability to operate in the fishery and provide corals to all these places around the world afford us the opportunity to also participate in this research, and we're definitely part of the solution by comparison to the picture that AMCS is painting.
All right, we've referenced AMCS a couple of times now. Simon Miller is with us. He's the Great Barrier Reef Fisheries Campaign Manager. Simon, why have you called for the end of wild coral export?
Yeah, thanks for having us for this important conversation today, Tegan. So, I mean, most Australians would be well aware that the Great Barrier Reef's under some pretty significant pressure from climate change. And we've seen, six mass bleaching events in the last 10 years now. Some of those have led to some really significant declines in overall coral cover, including the event that happened back in 2024. But on top of that, we've also got these other local pressures on the Great Barrier Reef. Some come from things like water pollution. Others come from fishing. And so one of the fishing threats to the Great Barrier Reef, and specifically to its corals, that tends to fly a bit under the radar is through the Queensland coral fishery. So that's why we've launched this campaign, and that's why we're trying to raise the awareness of that the fishery exists, how it operates, and what's occurring out there on the reef. Because it is our view that if more people knew about this, they would be pretty shocked and appalled that the Great Barrier Reef, a World Heritage Site, somewhere important to so many Australians, has corals being directly taken and sold into a global aquarium trade for profit. And so that's why we're launching this campaign, and we are looking to what the future can look like, what that solution can be. How can we transition the fishery and the operators in the fishery away from taking these healthy, resilient corals from the reef into something like aquaculture, where we can grow these corals in tanks so the trade can still exist. It's just not taking the corals from the reef.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting with Lyle Squire Jr., who's the CEO of Cairns Marine, and Simon Miller from the Australian Marine Conservation Society's Great Barrier Reef Fisheries campaign manager is Simon's role with the ACMS. We're talking about the fact that the Australian Marine Conservation Society is calling for live coral harvesting to be phased out by December 2028 in favour of aquaculture rather than taking corals from the reef. One of the top lines of the campaign, Simon, is this idea of 190 tonnes of coral that are able to be harvested and sold into the aquarium trade. That sort of sounds like the top end of what could be allowable under the legislation. Can you talk to me about where the provenance of this number is for you?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a few things to think about here, and Lyle's already touched on it there. So 190 tonnes is what's permitted to be taken by both the Queensland and Australian governments. So there's catch limits for individual species. And so if those were fully realised, 190 tonnes is the maximum that can be taken. The longer term average in recent years has generally been sitting between kind of 70 and 120 tonnes of corals that have been taken. And as Lyle suggested, the recent harvest in the last year or two has been down on that. I think it's been in the low 30s. So that is lower than what can be taken. But of course, there is that capacity for larger take to occur. And while all those different numbers are quite hard for people to fathom sometimes, like what does that actually mean? I would bring this back to really the question around sustainability. And so a lot of these harvest limits that are in place for the fishery were put in place after a period of quite rapid growth through the late 2010s, where the number of pieces of coral being harvested really started to skyrocket quite quickly. And so the catch limits aren't a bit set on sustainable harvest limits. We just don't have that kind of information available for many corals. You can't say that we can sustainably take 5 or 10 tonnes of a certain type of coral because we just haven't got that information. So instead, what they did was set the harvest limits based on historical catches during a period of pretty rapid growth in the fishery.
So,
In terms of the number of pieces.
Lyle, how do you respond to these questions around sustainability?
Oh, look, firstly, I've really questioned the use of some of the numbers that Simon's putting out there. With regards to the 190 tonne, it's actually physically not possible under the current management systems to take 190 tonne of hard coral within the fishery. As Simon alluded to, the actual number of kilos of corals that have actually been collected for the last 2 years is sitting at 25 tonne, which is considerably more. It's 13% of what AMCS has based the entire campaign on. Simon was saying in Sydney recently that, the coral take was like the equivalent of two trams every year. Clearly, that's not the case. Now, 25 tonnes still sounds like quite a lot, but to try and put that into some sort of perspective, and this also goes to that question about sustainability. If you looked at one hump-headed parrotfish that lives on the reef, they eat 5 tonne of coral per year. So effectively, 5 of these parrotfish on one single reef, and typically there's schools of 30 to 40 of these parrotfish on any given spot, 5 of these fish will eat more coral than the entirety of the coral fishery that's spread across 2,000 kilometres of coastline. So the federal minister was just on the reef the other day and was marvelling at how fantastic the condition of the corals were, the fish, the turtles, everything being healthy. And yet, despite all of that, there's multiple schools of these parrotfish swimming around eating way more coral than the coral fishery could ever hope to take.
Isn't that the parrotfish's job, though? Time. Like, that's its food. It's in its habitat.
Yeah, sure. But the reef has developed over time to be able to withstand that take. And if you look at the actual take of the fishery across the entirety of the resource, 350,000 square kilometres, the fishery only has the capacity with a footprint of 0.2% of the actual ground that we work. So it doesn't take too much to work out that it's a physical impossibility for this fishery not to be sustainable when you've, you're literally only a drop in the ocean.
Well, we approached the Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water for a statement about this. The spokesperson said coral harvest for both commercial and research purposes is highly regulated across Australia under a range of state, territory and Commonwealth legislation. Catch limits for coral within Queensland coral fishery are set by the Queensland government as part of its domestic fisheries management. Queensland coral fishery has undergone substantial changes since 2021, including implementing stricter reporting and catch requirements. And it continues, the Queensland government is scheduled to review and update the harvest strategy for Queensland coral fishery in October 2026, so only a few months' time from now. I'll put the full statement on the Life Matters website after the show. But Lyle, the campaign is very much around transitioning from live coral harvesting to growing coral on shore.
Yes.
Is that something that would be feasible for you and your business?
Look, I'm glad you've touched on that point because it's really the focal point of the campaign, and it's completely unfeasible to expect the wild harvest sector to transition to a complete aquaculture scenario. It's a bit like saying we're going to take all the cattlemen of Queensland and convert them to pharmacists because they both have a biological interest in animals. You're talking about a completely different skill set between wild harvesters and aquaculture, and you really have to view them as two very distinct, separate industries. They're not the same, and you can't expect the people in one set with a particular skill set, infrastructure and so forth, to just go across. And by 2028, that's a campaign date. It's not something that's been put forward by science or anybody else. This is something that AMCS has come up with as an appropriate time. And it's unrealistic. Everything about it is unrealistic.
Simon?
In terms of what we're looking for here, we obviously, from our perspective, we want to see this transition occur. We need to accept that the Great Barrier Reef over the next decade is probably going to start to look different to the Great Barrier Reef that we know now. And so what we are seeking to do here and what science is telling us is that we need to be doing everything we can to reduce all sources of coral mortality so that the healthy, resilient corals remain out there on the Great Barrier Reef to help it repopulate in those periods where it's under less pressure than others. And so in order to do that, we think we need to be transitioning away from the wild harvest of corals into aquaculture as quickly as possible. And while that may be easier for some operators than others, I completely acknowledge that for, as Lars said, like it may not be a straightforward transition for everyone. But this is why we are seeking and we're urging the Australian government to provide that support to help the industry transition. I think everyone needs to be in the same room together and pushing forward to really identify what the perfect solution here is, because in 10 years' time, the reef is going to look different. The fishery won't exist as it does now. And so if we start preparing for this transition now and start implementing it now, the trade of these corals can still exist. They'll just be farmed on land instead of taken from the reef. And so that's what we ultimately want to see. And we'd like to see everyone get together to try and work on this.
It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Simon Miller from the ACMS. He's the Great Barrier Reef Fisheries Campaign Manager. I'm also chatting with Lyle Squire Jr., who's the CEO of Cairns Marine. And you're telling me what you think about this story, a live harvest of corals from the Great Barrier Reef. Pretty differing views on the text line. One person says 180 tonnes, it was actually 190 that I said, what a non-story, an amazingly minuscule amount, probably more destroyed by pleasure boat anchors every day. How many gazillion tonnes are there in total? What is the ratio? It's like a square metre of grass being harvested in Kakadu. I think I need to do some back of the envelope maths there to fact check. Catherine says, this is a very interesting discussion. Quite frankly, given we are talking about one of the seven wonders of the world, which is under extreme pressure from climate change, not 1 ounce of coral should be harvested from that area to go in aquaria or anywhere else. Definitely not a consensus here on Life Matters. Well, I'm also joined by someone involved in the preservation of the reef. Dr. John Daly is a conservation biologist at Taronga Conservation Society Australia. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How resilient is the reef in terms of its capacity to withstand changes from climate change and from harvesting, etc.?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the Great Barrier Reef is still in relatively good health compared to some other regions of the world. There's still quite a lot of biodiversity and genetic diversity out there, and that does mean that there's still the ability to adapt. But we know that oceans are changing and bleaching events are increasing in frequency. And so a lot of the modelling that's been done is indicating that those impacts are going to continue to increase globally, and that includes here on the Great Barrier Reef and on Ningaloo Reef over in Western Australia. And so, the Great Barrier Reef is one of the best managed reef systems in the world, so we would expect that the Reef Authority will continue to take an evidence-based approach and adapt as necessary and keep doing what's best for the reef.
Tell me about the conservation work that you're doing with cryopreservation.
Yeah, so we've been cryopreserving and biobanking coral genetics since 2011. And so we use cryopreservation to secure the existing genetic diversity of the corals that are out on the reef. So we've actually got the largest collection of cryopreserved coral samples in the world at the Cryodiversity Bank. That's located in Sydney on Cammeraygal country, and a second site out in Dubbo on Wiradjuri country. And so basically that involves freezing coral sperm in liquid nitrogen, which is minus 190 degrees Celsius. And so they can remain frozen and alive for decades and used for breeding and things like that. And so that provides us with an insurance against the loss of genetics out on the reef, but it also provides a tool that can be used to support breeding programs. And it's an effective way to sort of support those breeding programs for resilient corals to support restoration.
Is this a break glass in case of emergency bank, or is this something that you sort of see being a live bank where things are coming in and going out of it regularly?
Yeah, so ideally it's a technology that's used to support a restoration industry. So having that reserve of genetics means that we can increase the genetics that are available for a breeding program beyond just what we can keep in an aquarium or can collect from the reef.
Sorry, do we still have you there, John?
Yeah, sorry.
Yes. Keep going.
And so those corals, those genetics can be used to produce new corals that can go out on the reef as part of those recovery programs.
Well, John, Simon and Lyle, thank you all so much for chatting with me today. Lyle Squire is the CEO of Cairns Marine. Simon Miller, Great Barrier Reef Fisheries Campaign Manager from the Australian Marine Conservation Society. And Dr. John Daly, Conservation Biologist at Taronga Conservation Society Australia. Thank you for your texts as well. One says, aquaculture is the solution to be embraced. The right thing to do can sometimes take work. Another, coral harvest for research is okay. Coral harvesting for people who want but don't need aquaria is not all right. And one more says, thanks to Lyle and Simon for coming on. It was great to hear both sides of the story, particularly the reality of how much coral is actually harvested. Well, this is Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Next, upcoming changes to Australia's unemployment system. Are these changes fair? Will they work? That's next.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm taking my phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story by Background Briefing. Sunday mornings at 9 on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
The federal government has just announced a major overhaul of the unemployment system that it says is ill-equipped to support many of the people who rely on it. About a million Australians are out of work and relying on JobSeeker, but only around 1 in 10 of them found long-term employment through a job provider last financial year. The plan is to change the way support is provided to people depending on their needs rather than the current one-size-fits-all approach. Here's the Employment Minister, Amanda Rishworth, explaining the issues with the current system at the National Press Club yesterday.
People with more complex barriers to employment simply get put in the too hard basket, what's known in the system commonly as parking. 20% of the Workforce Australia caseload has been stuck in the system for over 5 years. This figure is just too high.
So does this sound like a fairer system? Will it actually help people who are out there find meaningful work faster? Well, if you've had to deal with this system, I would really love to hear your experience. How hard was it to get back into the workforce? Did you have the support you needed to get back on your feet? Kerry Forrest is one person who's seen this up close. She's relied on JobSeeker in the past and is currently working two casual jobs while looking for secure, ongoing work. Kerry, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tegan. No worries.
How are you getting by at the moment?
I actually live on mortgage redraws because when I left my permanent job because of systematic bullying in 2022, I was able to take out all of my super or most of it and pay it into my mortgage. So I'm basically living on that because I'm not getting enough work.
Right.
And
you're not working. Sorry, keep going, Kerry.
I'm doing a casual relief job, which is a state government job, but casual relief. So I'm basically checking my phone from 7 o'clock in the morning to see if I'm required. I can't make plans because I don't know if I'm going to be working. And I do have an ongoing casual job, but I've lost hours. I'm back to basically one shift a week on the casual security job that I do as well. And they're great employers, but I just really need more hours. I can't pay out my mortgage. I want to be able to retire one day, and I can't at the moment.
We didn't know if we were going to get to talk to you this morning because you were waiting by the phone to know if you were going to be called into work today.
Yep. Yes. I wasn't sure.
So you're not on JobSeeker payments right now, but what was your experience like when you were looking through those employment agencies?
I was dealing mostly with Workforce Australia directly, and reporting my hours and income to Centrelink on the app. But they did in the end, just before I was taken off Centrelink, I was referred to a job agency. But this is something I don't think should ever have been privatised. The old CES, if an employer had a job and needed a person, they had one point to go to. And people say, yes, they can advertise on Seek. I'm sorry, but serious job seekers don't look at Seek. I'm sorry, Seek has given me recommendations because I'm working in a hospital. They've given me recommendations for surgeons. I mean, it's the stuff, the algorithm just doesn't work. And they're offering me jobs in Melbourne and things like that. And I'm in Tasmania. So there was that one point of call. So all the job seekers went there and we looked at the little cards. I remember doing it when I was like 16. Look at the little cards and that. Employers seeking staff contacted them. Now, who do they contact? Like there's squillions of them and they come and go all the time. Like they're changing names, they're changing staff. And quite frankly, I don't think it should be given to a for-profit organisation like that, because if they find me a job, a permanent full-time job, and I leave them, they've lost funding, haven't they?
Mm. Well, we will speak to the peak body that represents these employment agencies in just a tick. Also here with me is Edwina McDonald, who's the Acting CEO and Chief Strategy Officer for ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Service. Edwina, what are you hearing when you hear Kerry's story?
Oh, Kerry, look, I'm really sorry to hear the experience you've had, but also sadly it's all too familiar. We've heard, and the Minister has acknowledged this now, that this is a fundamentally broken system and it's one that's causing harm, and the way in which it's operating isn't supporting people into paid work when they're very much looking for it. It's creating barriers to people getting work because it's creating, you know, busy work that's not actually meaningful or leading to meaningful and sustained employment.
So Edwina, when you're looking at the changes that have been announced, what really stands out for you?
So I think there's a few things, and I think the acknowledgement from the Minister that this system is broken and harming people is really noteworthy because there is a lot of evidence about the harm that it's caused. And she's talking about having the supports much more tailored to what people need, looking at changing how the funding is so that it's not so much focused on just outcomes of getting people through the door as fast as possible, but actually looking at meaningful outcomes for people and looking at, she's very clear about the quality of the services. What she's setting up is a reform process. And so what we know is needed is a fundamental overhaul of this system. And for that to happen, it needs to be more than three streams of services. We need to be looking at addressing, as Kerry has said, the model of commissioning, of contracting of these services. The competition model, the privatisation model is a really key part of what has led to this low quality service of a focus on getting people through as cheaply and fastly as possible rather than on a culture that is really fundamentally and genuinely interested in supporting people into employment. So that's a really key part of it. The other bit that looks like the Minister and the government won't be touching is the penalty and the compliance framework. And that is very harmful. We've seen successive ombudsman reports and loads of evidence around the harm that is causing, that people their payments are suspended automatically and, you know, there've been even illegal cancellations through that system. And so it's very concerning to us that system, that the penalties and the compliance part of mutual obligations look like they'll be staying in place, because it's really clear to us that that is not at all helpful in supporting people into employment, and worse still, it is very harmful.
So, Edwina, just if you know about this system, you really, really know. If you don't, perhaps that might have brushed past you a little bit. Can you talk a bit more about what you're talking about there with mutual obligations and penalties?
So for people who are receiving payments like JobSeeker, and Kerry was talking a bit about this, there are requirements that they have to complete in order to receive the payment. So that can be things like attending appointments, completing job applications, training programs, work activities. So one example of a requirement that people are facing is having to apply for 20 jobs a month. And that can be ridiculous, because then you're applying for jobs that, you know, you may not be qualified for, may not be appropriate, but because you just have to meet this target. And then what happens if you don't meet the target, if you miss a requirement, and even if that's because of illness, it could be because of caring responsibilities, it could be because of administrative issues, then your payment can be suspended or even cancelled. So we've got these activities that are meaningless and actually can be a barrier to getting employment. And then we have these penalties that come in that mean people who are already struggling to survive on a daily basis on a woefully inadequately low payment suddenly find themselves without any money at all. So what the minister's been talking about is looking at the activities to make those more meaningful and actually supportive. But what we're not hearing is that they're looking at addressing those penalties that are leaving people in situations where there's just no money at all to put any food on the table.
It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting with Edwina McDonald from the Australian Council of Social Service. You've also heard from Kerry Forrest, who's relied on JobSeeker in the past and is currently working two casual jobs while looking for secure ongoing work. A really stressful situation she's found herself in. And I did say that you'd hear from the peak body of the employment services industry. Well, Catherine Mandler is CEO of the National Employment Services Association. Catherine, you're representing these job providers that are tasked by the government to help people find work. Do you agree that the system needs a shake-up?
Oh, absolutely, Tegan. This reform is long overdue, and we really do need to move to a much more flexible system where we have adequate funding. So we have manageable caseloads. The minister yesterday at the press club announced the third stream, the more intensive stream for people with complex needs. It really needs to be acknowledged that providers today are already delivering for cohorts with really, really horrible backstories, domestic violence, homelessness, drug and alcohol abuse. They've been in the child protection system. And, they're delivering with very high caseloads, people coming through their doors, under a very punitive framework that's quite rigid and doesn't give them the flexibility to service these people in a way that's really tailored for their unique needs.
What does the role of the fact that we're currently dealing with very low unemployment, Catherine, what does that mean for the work that job providers or job service providers are trying to do?
Yes, so the caseload has changed from the days when we had quite high unemployment. So with lower unemployment, there are a lot of people who are quite easy to place. A lot of those people are already moving into jobs because there's quite a lot of labour shortages across multiple sectors in Australia. And so the caseload, the 4.5% unemployment caseload, what we're seeing now is a much higher proportion of people with really complex needs. So it's absolutely imperative that this punitive, rigid, overmanaged approach that we currently have shifts to actually be more responsive to this different caseload that we've got. You know, I think the key challenge will be we've got the digital service, which is provided by government already, Workforce Australia Online. There's a lot of people who've been stuck in the online system, languishing away without any service. And we know that when we, particularly for young people, we've had young people there for up to 12 months, you know, even longer, without actually getting adequate services, they get further and further from the labour market. Their self-esteem goes down, their motivation goes down. And then you need to do a lot more work, and it's much more intensive and costly to bring them back into and closer to a job that's actually going to meet their needs. So we need a system that's much more timely, that's much more responsive, and stops people falling through the gaps, and gives people the choice to go directly to a provider that can actually meet their individual needs and give them the skills, the confidence, and the training that they need to bring them closer to a job that's going to be meaningful and that they're actually going to be able to keep, that'll be sustainable. And we need more funding for that post-placement support to help providers support people through the early days of job placements. You know, those first 3 to 6 months are actually quite critical, because for people who haven't been in employment for a while, learning how a work setting actually operates, you know, the rules and the governance and the ways of working, the cultures around that, it's really important that they're supported through that. And it's also important, if it's not working, that they're still engaging with their provider so that they can actually potentially be placed elsewhere if that's not the right job for them.
You're telling me your stories on the text line 0418 226 576. One says, I live with disability and I've had first-hand experience with job providers. In my experience, they never even offered me a job. I just had my appointment every 2 weeks and I had to go in for that. Ask me if I'd found a job and I would say no, and they would go, okay. Anything changed when they know? And they would say, see you next time. Another says, I was on JobSeeker for a few years while I was underemployed. I found the job provider company to be absolutely useless, providing no tangible and no useful support and chasing up needless bureaucratic box-ticking tasks. I had to partake in a Work for the Dole program, which gave me no substantive skills and reduced my ability to work in my paid job. I eventually landed a full-time job entirely off my own bat, and then the provider attempted to claim they got me the job so they could claim bonuses from the government. Catherine, there's quite a few texts talking about how ineffective and unhelpful job providers have been. How do you respond to that criticism?
Yeah, look, I really want to acknowledge the lived experience that you're hearing about today. And we really need to learn what was actually going on for each participant and what settings actually need to change to give them a much better response. So what a lot of people in the public wouldn't realise, that everything providers do is micromanaged in a very detailed and overly prescriptive contract. And that's the basis for their agreement with government and actually providing the service. So their hands are tied. It's quite a controlling relationship, and there are things that they must do. And I was trying not to laugh when the text you read out was talking about the bureaucratic box ticking task, and that causes providers no end of frustration when we've currently got a front line that's spending 50% of their time on administrative and regulatory tasks created by government, which are really not doing much to help them, give them more time to actually engage with job seekers and help them into jobs. Just think about that. 50% of frontline staff's time is taken up with administrative work for government, and that's taking time away from their time with job seekers and actually engaging with employers to find the right type of work that would suit that person.
So the Commonwealth Ombudsman report raised concerns along the lines of a high rate of provider decisions were overturned, that there were concerns about quality, consistency and appropriateness of decision making that lead to people's payments being cancelled, as we were talking about with Edwina before. Catherine, how do we improve this quality?
Yeah, look, we all work in a system. You know, participants are coming into that system. We've got a range of providers. We've got lots of charities, not-for-profits. We've got private companies, you know, small family employment services right through to larger companies. And in the Indigenous employment space, we've got Indigenous local councils delivering employment programs. So it's quite an eclectic mix of providers that are constrained in actually how they deal with job seekers. So the new system moving forward needs to give much more flexibility and agency to providers to be able to help the people that they put up their hands. You know, no one puts up their hand to work in frontline employment services because they love administrivia and box ticking and doing regulatory tasks. You know, show me one frontline staff person who thinks that actually is a meaningful job for them. They actually sign up for employment services because we have a workforce with significant lived experience of incarceration, homelessness, domestic violence, child protection. And these people put up their hand to help those who've had similar experiences to them and help them into jobs. We're seeing enormous turnover in our sector because we work under, you know, very fiscally restrained settings, very onerous prescriptive, you must do this, this is how you will do it, and these are the outcomes you've got to achieve in this time to get a good performance rating. So we've got to start bringing a bit more humanity and dignity back in the system, not just for participants but for providers, but we've also got to bring it in for the employers that we're working with so that we can actually work at a community level to develop something. And I'm really keen on the co-design with government, bringing all relevant stakeholders into the mix to actually design something that's really designed for the real world to get the outcomes that government's trying to get with this reform.
Sounds like there's some frustration on all sides there. I do want to raise the other elephant in the room here, which is just the amount of job seeker. On the text line, one person says, thanks for talking about this. I've been on job seeker since graduating and the system doesn't work. $400 a week is a very stressful amount of money to live on. This person continues, every job I apply for, I get a generic rejection of, we had an unprecedented number of applicants. They finish, the job provider is absolutely useless. Edwina, I do want to talk about this amount of money, which we've heard from many people, not just that one text, is barely enough to keep a roof over their head. Has that been addressed?
We know that amount of money is just woefully inadequate, and we've had successive recommendations from the government's own Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee around the urgent need to increase that payment to bring people out of poverty. We haven't seen any significant increase to that payment, and we know that it is putting people in positions where, you know, that they are skipping meals, they're, you know, making choices about, you know, can you actually eat protein or vegetables, going without medicine, not being able to put a roof over your head, and in the job context, you know, you can't afford clothes for an interview, a haircut, transport to the interview. But really fundamentally, you've got a payment that is affecting people's health. It's affecting mental health and physical health. And when you're just struggling to survive and all your energy is going into working out how on earth you're going to eat, there is nothing left to be able to be looking for a job, to be putting yourself out there, to be well enough to do it, to have the confidence to do it, or just to even have any brain space to be thinking about that. Mm-hmm. So we know that a really fundamental part of this picture is increasing job seeker youth allowance, which is even lower, and other working age payments to around, you know, the pension level, which is $600, which would be bringing people out of poverty and into a position where they would actually be able to be better placed to be looking for work.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your insights today. Edwina McDonald, Acting CEO and Chief Strategy Officer for ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Service. Catherine Mandler, CEO of National Employment Services Association, which is the peak body for employment service providers in Australia. And you heard from Kerry Forrest as well. She relied on JobSeeker in the past, currently working two casual jobs while looking for secure ongoing work. And Kerry's experiences reflected also from you on the text line, unemployed for 2 years after redundancy, says one person, not on Centrelink, surviving on super, have tried agencies, they don't even ring back. Another person says the proposed system still doesn't address age discrimination. And Greg suggests that people, for whatever reason, ought to be able to join a national service program of environmental rehabilitation or social service for a basic wage for as long as they like. Well, it's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, is the teenage child in your house also tech support? There are some new stats that show Gen Z might still need a bit of help on the digital front.
I just thought it was a dream.
Restoration Australia is back.
We were in love. We figured we'd work it out.
In a remarkable new season.
A very big job that we've taken on, but an exciting opportunity.
Every dream restoration starts with something worth holding on to.
This is going to be quite a ride.
I see a romance in bringing things back to life.
Restoration Australia.
This is magnificent.
Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
Kids these days, it feels like they came out of the womb knowing how to operate a smartphone. Their tiny baby thumbs were already texting, live streaming, finding their way around algorithms. But the numbers say otherwise. There's new data from the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority that shows that in 2025, only 37% of Year 10 students in Australia were proficient in digital skills, which actually shocked me. If the kids can't even keep up with this newfangled techie world, what hope do the rest of us have? It's social studies time. Dan Woodman is Professor of Sociology at the University of Melbourne. Dan, welcome back to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan.
Who's the tech wizard in your house?
Well, I'm going to use this to give a cheeky shout out to my basketball team this morning, the Huskies, because we won our first grand final in about 15 years last night.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm going to bring it back to the topic because I spent about 15 minutes this morning putting together a social media post with me with my gold medal. It was a big event for me. And my kids would have done that in about a minute and a half. And they definitely do help me with those kind of tech skills. But other things about understanding how algorithms work and how we might understand the data that's being collected about us and presented to us, I'm probably a little bit ahead of my kids, but I tell you, they are catching up.
It was a very elaborate flex to talk about your gold medal just then, Dan. I appreciate it. It was seamless. No one noticed. It was very, very good. With this data that's come out, though, it's really shocking to me that like a third of kids are proficient in digital skills by the time they're like 15, 16 years old. What skills are we talking about here?
We need to put a couple of caveats on the results. So the number of people proficient has dropped a little bit since the last time they did the testing, which was 3 years ago. So for year six, it was from 55% down to 50. And then for year 11, 46 down to 37. But they actually changed the time of the year that they do the testing from the end of the year to May. So it's a couple of terms earlier in the year. So some of the changes in the results will be just to do with testing people at a different time in the year. But irrespective of that, it is worth noticing that it is only one third of people in year 10 who are reaching this level of proficiency. And that doesn't mean that they can't do a good pithy post or even make a brain rot AI video in less than 30 seconds. But it was things like designing algorithms, setting up a web form to get feedback on how users were using your website, analysing website data and those kind of things that they were testing, which looks like the students weren't performing as well as maybe ideally we'd hope to prepare them for the world they're going into.
Okay, so that feels like a job skill. What about I think a lot of the anxiety around digital literacy is about knowing what's real, knowing what's fake, knowing how to be a critical thinker and a critical consumer of digital media. Did it look at that?
It did. It mixed together a lot of things, and it was a little bit hard to tell from the results because it was a kind of overall index of their abilities that they put together using the tests where the big gaps were. But people have pointed out that maybe being able to design a good PowerPoint presentation or even skills around algorithms and coding that 5 years ago we might have told everyone was the future of work and what they should be doing, that's changing pretty quickly. And those broader, I guess, digital literacy skills of knowing what digital data can do and what it can't, and when to trust things and when not, and when to trust but verify is really important skills that I think might be where we should be focusing in the next iteration of designing our digital curriculums.
So if we're looking at these data and going, okay, Gen Z's digital skills aren't where we thought that they would be, is the generational digital divide real, or is it maybe a bit of a myth?
Yeah, as I was saying, in some areas my children are way ahead of me. But I guess what these tests and the findings show us is that just being exposed to it and using something a lot doesn't mean you have all the necessary, I guess, more academic skills to use it well and to also be a critical user. And I don't think necessarily other generations are any better. But one of the things is that if you're in school, you're getting taught this by people who are, by definition, from an older generation. And it's like, it's an area where things are evolving so quickly. I do feel sorry for teachers in that this is just adding one more area where keeping your skills and knowledge up to date to be able to teach for the world you're preparing your students for just seems to get harder and harder.
Dan, I know that you're not an education academic, but you do educate people. What kind of approach do we maybe have if this field is moving so quickly and it is so hard to keep up with the day-to-day skills? What are sort of some of the broad frameworks we can be looking at then?
Yeah, well, so I teach in a university, and we're really struggling to adapt on the run to the rise of new AI tools that students can use and sometimes arguably abuse as well. So yeah, we're trying to get people to think about using tools well, not just using them as easily as possible. But that's it. There's so much in our life that pushes towards getting the quick answer and putting together the quick analysis of the website analytic data and not taking our time. And I think it's going to be a kind of thing where if you want to be able to use these tools, unfortunately, we're going to have to be doing lifelong learning and returning to what we know over and over again.
Well, that's kind of the picture in your family, isn't it? It's not just the purview of the young when it comes to being tech savvy.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know how long it's going to be till I next get a chance to win a grand final, but I imagine it will be AI Dan that's doing the post, and who knows, it might even be Robot Dan on the court by that point. But either way, I think my children will be living their lives in a world that looks very, very different with this technology. And I guess good luck to them and all of us and the people who are teaching them for that world to come.
People are texting me about this. One recently retired says, this opening question makes me wonder, at what point do people learn to type? The most basic of digital skills I initially learned on a typewriter in my 30s. I became fairly fluent in touch typing in an evening typing class. This serves me well at work now. What is the usual way people learn now? And what is the base skill level now? Another says, I'm 60, so I've seen tech change from the first home video game. Yes, Dan, it seems like being a bit self-taught and being open-minded might be the key when it comes to keeping up with the times on the tech front.
Yes, yeah, and listening to Life Matters.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that goes without saying. Dan Woodman, as always, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tegan.
Professor Dan Woodman takes a break from his real job of teaching sociology at the University of Melbourne once a fortnight for our segment, Social Studies. It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Thank you so much for your texts on job seeking and our unemployment system in Australia that needs a bit of an overhaul, as the federal government has announced it will overhaul it. Julia says, I've worked for a job centre network as their counsellor for over 10 years. The system absolutely needs to change. The staff have far too many KPIs and endless requirements that are pointless. What job seekers require is much more help finding employment, especially now that AI is involved. And on tech savviness between the generations, Greg says one of the greatest tensions in our household of two aged people is the use of technology, or rather not being able to use it. Comes down largely to their fear of getting it wrong and not feeling safe to play with the technology. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters today. I've come to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow, you'll have Beverly Wang with you. She wants to talk about your relationship with gambling. It's Bev with you tomorrow here on Life Matters, and I'll catch you again on Monday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.